to your wayward daughter, who's been such a long time gone. I heard your voice, I had no choice, it was calling me home.
Well, folks, welcome back here to another edition of Mighty Tom's Bible Study. And, of course, I'm your host, Mighty Tom. It's good to have you all here today, listening in, tuning in, podcasting in, and all those other things. I apologize for the lack of a study last week. I might do, I'm doing another study for, at a school right now for, doing Acts, so I might just throw in Acts to sort of keep up the weekly thing going on. But we'll see what happens. We'll just see what happens. So I would like to take a couple of seconds and point everybody to a new website that I have going on with a group of friends. It's called StopSleepParalysis.org. StopSleepParalysis. ParalysisOrg. And what we're doing here is we've noticed that people who suffer from sleep paralysis end up having symptoms that are very much like the 16th and 17th century accounts of demonic activity, things like that. So what we're trying to do is help people get free from that, and we've run into some really good results. Get free of sleep paralysis using the name and the power and authority of Jesus Christ. So I would direct anybody and everybody there to take a look at that and check that out if you've not already done so. So where were we? We left off 2 weeks ago there on John 5. So let's do John 5 here and just see where we're at. Verse 1 is, "After this there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem." So now this feast was one of the feasts of the Jews, where you have to go down to Jerusalem and do a specific ascribed couple of different things. Now there were three feasts like this, and they were of agricultural significance as well as commemorative as far as national, in the way, by the way of national events. So thus you've got the Passover, which is connected to the barley harvest, and at the same time also recalling the Exodus from Egypt. Then you have Pentecost, which has an agricultural phase, which is like the celebration, also the celebration of the wheat harvest. It has a religious phase in the Jewish liturgy based on the rabbinical calculation, which makes it the day of the giving of the law, their Pentecost. And this religious side has sort of so completely overshadowed the agricultural that among modern Jews, the Pentecost has become Confirmation Day, if you will. And you can check out Exodus 34, Leviticus 23:10 on that. Also Numbers 28, those different places there. And that should give you a look at all of those things. And then there is the Feast of Tabernacles, or Sukkoth, Haggai's Hafis, or however they say that. As bad as my Greek pronunciation is, my Hebrew pronunciation may be worse. Well, not maybe, it is. Which is the anniversary, sort of the Feast of Tabernacles. First of all, the agricultural significance of it is it's sort of the general harvest festival, and the annual anniversary by rabbinical calculation of the beginnings of the wanderings in the wilderness. Now, the interesting thing is that if we know that if we can at some point know, and we don't currently know now, some people say they think they know, but I'm not convinced. If we can say that this is another Passover, we can really get an exact idea of how long Jesus' ministry was. That is, this would be, if this was a Passover here, this feast here was a Passover, then we can say Jesus' ministry was exactly 3.5 years. So that's an interesting little tidbit there, a little sidebar. Let's see. Verse 2. Now there is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has 5 roofed colonnades. Okay, so the Sheep Gate. The Sheep Gate was one of the 12 gates to the city there in Jerusalem. Now recall that all the cities there at this time, they have walls to keep from invaders, right? That's something you can miss pretty easily unless you're, I don't know, thinking about it. Now the Sheep Gate, like I said, was one of the 12 gates into old Jerusalem there. And this was actually, this gate was actually unearthed fairly recently. Not the Sheep Gate, but rather the pool. They unearthed this pool here a couple of years ago. And whenever you do any excavation in Jerusalem, you have to have an archaeological expert on hand to watch the dig. So what was going on here, this church here, it had and I think it was a Greek Orthodox church in Jerusalem, it was having some land dug up, and this archaeological expert there that you have to have on site when you do work in old Jerusalem, he must have had some sort of word from the Lord or something, or just something like that, because while they were digging, they unearthed a single Roman step. You know, they're digging, and he looks at that and goes, looks around, and he was sitting there looking at it, and it was just, I guess it was like this. He looked at it for about 30 seconds, and he goes, those two steps there are old Roman from about 0 AD. This must be the pool of Bethesda. anyway, he got that from just two Roman steps, is the story that I heard. As is always the case in Jerusalem, there's always a twisty story to what's going on behind the archaeology. I kind of dig the, no pun intended, I kind of dig those stories there with the people there in the back behind the scenes, what's going on and how things work there with different people and how they do things like that. The last I heard, though, the interesting, the sad sort of thing about this, so this Greek Orthodox Church unearths the Sheep Gate, or not the Sheep Gate, gosh, I've said it twice, the pool, the Bethesda pool there. The church was going to have it, the last I heard, the church was actually going to have it torn out and excavated, and they were going to put some type of orchard there, something stupid like that. Yeah, it's kind of sad. Verse 3. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. Okay, now count closely from verse 1. I'm going to show you something. This is, to me, kind of like a big eye-popping doodad here. Now, how many verses are there between verse 1 and verse 5? Now, this sounds like a silly question, but go ahead and count. Dun, 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 dun. If you came up with the answer, what is 4? You didn't miscount. So you probably think like, okay, well, I'll just chuck out my New Living Translation and go on to the real deal and whip out my ESV or my old rusty trusty KJV. And my answer to you is do it, I dare you. You will find that verse 4 is missing in those too. Now if you look for it in the NASB, you will see it, interestingly enough. So now that I've made you look and see that verse 4 is missing, I'll tell you what it's all about. Verse 4 is a victim of good scholarship, you might say. paleographers and old manuscript experts have discovered that in roughly 24 of the best manuscripts, verse 4 is not there. Or the scribe put an asterisk there to indicate to the next scribe that the verse was inaccurate, a later addition, or otherwise heavily suspect. This wasn't figured out until about 1900. So in Bibles printed before 1900, it's listed as is, without brackets or without any sort of notation. So again, the idea is, what gives? Well, now this is where things start to get real interesting. So many of Jesus' miracles, as I've said several times here in this Bible study, are based on some sort of folksy superstition, where halfway through the superstition, Jesus steps outside the old wives' tale and performs the miracle. The sort of, you know, old wives' tale superstition in this case was that an angel comes and stirs the water once a year, and the first person in gets healed. We know that, it's easy to see. If we watch the scene in our head, we see Jesus looking at the invalid and perceiving he's been there waiting for the waters to stir. Indeed, he's been an invalid for 38 years, right? He asks the invalid man if he wants to be healed. And the lame man replies, probably thinking that, well, if I tell him my need, he will bring me to the water, and maybe then I could get healed. Well, instead of that, Jesus steps outside this folksy old wives' tale sort of superstition and heals the man without using any of the water. To Jesus' audience, this would have been spectacular. This superstition of the angel and the water would have also been known to the immediate audience and would have really needed no explanation, hence no need to record it. But as the Gospel of John got further and further away from its original social mores of Judaism, it would have needed to be included for people to grasp this clearly. So what John was practically doing was what we have, you know, we don't have verse 4. What's going on is that he didn't need to put it there. So he's sort of like focusing, the original manuscripts are focusing a little bit more closely on Jesus and what he did. But as it gets further away, they feel a need to sort of include this one line so people will get the idea of the superstition. Now, when I figured all this out via the help of a bunch of old manuscripts and some really intelligent paleographers being so kind as to answer my emails, it took me like 2 hours just to get the grin off my face. It's like, man, that's cool. We see Jesus' power even in the quote-unquote textual faults. And I use that term very loosely here. I remember Chuck Missler saying that every number, every place name, and every letter and space is there by design. This case of the missing verse here in John 5 makes a very strong case for that. What's going on here is just, it's fascinating, you know? So there. Check it out. I hope I explained that well. Maybe I'll have to go back and listen to this. Verse 5. One man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him, this is verse 6, when Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be healed?" So when Jesus asked this person, "Do you want to be healed?" Now, some Bibles translate this word whole, like as in, you know, like a whole piece of pie or something. The word here for healed is hugase, which means a little bit like not just healed, although that seems to be the primary meaning, but it also kind of carries the implication of being made whole. Now, check concordance and scriptural references here just to make sure that I'm not crazy. Because, you know, sometimes I make mistakes. And I actually had an argument about this with somebody, the Oversight Committee on Mighty Tom Bible Studies, actually. The fact that Jesus asked this question and the answer the invalid gives also tends to suggest that the implication is that Jesus is asking the blind man if he wants to be healed. But the blind man's response, Like the Samaritan woman and the disciples and Nicodemus all show that Jesus, because he is God, can work outside the paradigm and outside the preconceived notions of God. You know, that's what he's doing. He's going to heal this guy. Not taking him to the water. Verse 7. The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I am going, another steps down before me." So the sick man is likely answering out of his place of need. Well, more than likely answering out of his place of need. I'm pretty positive of it. He's telling Jesus why he hasn't been healed, why he's there, and what he's asking Jesus for, by implication anyway. Help. He wants help getting put in the water. He sees the pool as his salvation. Now Jesus sees this as a great idea, as a great time to sort of manifest his power by working a miracle outside the normal paradigm of the believers and doing something miraculous and amazing, so that his power gets focused on him. As we're going to see here in the next verse in just a second. Verse 8, Jesus said to him, "Get up, take up your bed, and walk." So there it is. Jesus heals the man. Working outside what the person thought the normal paradigm was, really the normal paradigm for all the believers gathered, you know, all the people there, even outside the social paradigm. We see this again and again in how God moves. Check out this man of God. What I mean by that is, I guess he works in sort of backward ways that we wouldn't expect, outside the social paradigm, and definitely outside the normal paradigm. So check this guy out. He was raised in a Unitarian church. His mother had sent him. His father died when he was very young, so his mother had to send him away to work for his room and board, where he was given cornmeal and porridge 3 times a day. He moved to Boston when he was 17 and was converted to evangelical Christianity when he was told by the preacher of that church how much God loved him. However, first his application for church membership in May of 1855 was rejected. He was not even received as a church member until May 4th, 1856. As his teacher, Edward Kimball, stated, "I can truly say, and in saying it, I magnify the infinite grace of God as bestowed upon me, that I have seen few persons whose mind were spiritually darker than was his when he came into my Sunday school class. And I think that the committee of the Mount Vernon Church seldom met an applicant for membership more unlikely ever to become a Christian of clear and undecided views of gospel truth, still less to fill any extended sphere of public usefulness. So, think about that for a second. This guy, even his teacher, was saying, this guy's a mess. He's never going to amount to anything. This guy turned out to be D.L. Moody. We see that God works outside of what we think of him doing and what we think he will do, and outside of what other people think he will do. This is really an interesting character trait of God. And I don't think it can be... I mean, for me, this is, I guess, speaking autobiographically, I learn a lot doing these Bible studies. And this is an important point, I think, for you, the listener, but also for me. God is going to work many times outside of what anybody thinks he's going to do. And the reason he does that, I would surmise, is that he's trying to bring glory to him. He's getting people to look on him for their salvation and their healing and their truth and their joy and all those other things. Verse 9. "And at once the man was healed. He took up his bed and walked." Now that day was the Sabbath. So again, we see Jesus working here, everyone working outside everyone's expectations, especially the Pharisees. He moves on the Sabbath and heals someone. Now, the wild thing is how everyone misses what he's done. You have the Pharisees, You have the Pharisees here who've begun to question him and don't know what's going on. The Pharisees obviously were a little bit perturbed about John the Baptist. Well, they're really perturbed about Jesus, and as we're going to see here just in a little bit. But it doesn't just stop with the Pharisees being unclear about what was going on with the with Jesus. We saw this in everybody else. We saw this with the Samaritan woman, with Nicodemus. We saw with the money changers there in the temple. We see this again and again and again. Jesus does these miracles so people will look to him, and they're confused about it all. You know, Nicodemus, he doesn't get the whole idea of the being born again. You know, the Samaritan woman doesn't get it, but Jesus meets them all where they are and pulls him to him. You know, let's see, verse 10. So the Jews said to the man who had been healed, "It is the Sabbath, and it is not lawful for you to take up your bed." So the rules for what you could do and what you couldn't do on the Sabbath were long. A tailor was advised to put down his needle a half hour before sunset, lest he inadvertently carry it on the Sabbath while searching for fleas in his cloth. Which I thought was goofy. In an effort to make life somewhat functional on Sabbath, the sages created a vast system of causality that defined boundaries in every location. These boundaries artificially established the limits of one's domicile. For instance, it might include a whole section of city. Certain areas, while physically outside one's home, still remained within the limits of one's domain, so as not to transgress the commands of Exodus 16:29 to stay in one's place. However, in one very strict sect, the Kerarites, they wouldn't leave their home on the Sabbath under any circumstances. You recall in, I believe it was the Yom Kippur War that the enemies of then Israel, well, then Israel, they're still around, the enemies of Israel actually attacked on the Sabbath, because people wouldn't go. You know, people wouldn't. They knew that people were going to be in their houses all day. As far as candle lighting times, this is an interesting one. It is a major responsibility for all Jews to honor the Sabbath or festival by lighting candles 18 minutes before sunset. This unique commandment entrusted to the Jewish woman is rich with meaning and purpose. So says the text, anyway. In a world so full of darkness, the candles lit by Jewish women and girls bring light, joy, and holiness. It is very important to know the exact candle lighting time, because we are not allowed under any circumstances to kindle these or any other lights after sunset. However, despite all these warnings about keeping the Sabbath, rarely does Scripture give examples of what actually constitutes work. So the Pharisees here really have to make all this stuff up. It's weird, you know? They're just making it up. Here we go. Random stuff. You can find in other places you have provisions against kindling, gathering firewood or manna, Exodus 35:3-15, Numbers 15:32, and Exodus 16, and even carrying a burden there in Nehemiah chapter 13. Yet these acts require definition. How much was a burden? What could be considered kindling? Now, on the other hand, it's like, you know, the law of love and the law of liberty. Was it lawful for Jesus to heal on the Sabbath? Yes, because it came from a place of love and from a place of showing people the Father, a place of renewal. which was greater than any Sabbath commandment. You know, love your neighbor, love God, or, well, not in that order, love God and love your neighbor. To that instance, you know, he was loving this man by healing him and showing him who he was. Very interesting. We got a little bit off track there. It's okay. Verse 11. But he answered them, "The man who healed me, that man said to me, 'Take up your bed and walk.'" So the Pharisees are wondering why this man is wandering around on the Sabbath, seeing it inviolatable, even by God. And that's really one of the ideas there behind Phariseeism. It is my opinion that the Pharisees, in putting up the walls and having the walls there, what they did, people will argue that Jesus was a Pharisee. And I don't know if I agree with that for a couple of reasons. One is that it is a completely different mindset to know that you can violate the Sabbath and all of these other goofy man-made commandments through the law of love. You know, it makes everything else sort of pale in comparison. So that's what's going on there. Verse 12 and 13. They asked him, "Who is the man who said to you, 'Take up your bed and walk'?" Now the man who had been healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn, as there was a crowd in the place. Now what's interesting is that you can make this episode... that's 12 and 13, obviously. Now what's interesting is that you can make this episode with the crippled man... into even a microcosm of Israel and the Messiah. He goes to heal a crippled man, steps outside their expectations and heals him. Because it wasn't in accordance with their rules, the whole thing was viewed by the Pharisees as unrighteous or wrong. Now the Pharisees often carried these rules to the extreme, as we saw in sampling just a couple of verses ago. This may be why Jesus said things like Matthew 23:15, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel across sea and land to make a single proselyte, and when he becomes a proselyte, you make him twice as much a child of hell as yourselves." So that's what's going on there. You know, they burden these guys down with goofy rules that aren't explicitly in the Bible. Let's see, verse 14. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you." Now, Jesus here is giving this guy some interesting intel, if you will. Don't sin because something worse may happen to you. And yet how often this goes on with all of us. You get healed, then praise the Lord for a while, and then pretty soon you're back to the same old again. You know, the Lord doesn't leave, the Lord doesn't move, and, you know, maybe that's all training or, you know, he's working on you or something. It's tough to always know what the Lord is doing, I find here, especially in my own life, you know. But it's important that we both understand that, you know, God, on the one hand, God loves us the way we are. You know, he'll come after us even though we are horribly sinful and draw us to him. But on the other hand, he doesn't want that sin to continue. He wants us to not sin anymore. So, yeah. Verse 15, "The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had healed him." So it's a good thing to remember here that the Jews were serious about the whole Sabbath thing. It could result in excommunication or death. So this guy wasn't just necessarily a turncoat. And whatever you're feeling about his action of the crippled man going to Jesus, he had some serious motives about it, and yet perhaps did not realize maybe even Jesus was the Messiah. Now, I'm not saying what the crippled man, formerly crippled man here, did was right. More like he very well may have done it out of maybe a little bit of arrogance and some fear. And, you know, to be honest, it's not like Jesus can't handle himself, you know. Let's see, verse 16. And this was why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. Now this, like no other thing, makes for a perfect encapsulation of why the Pharisees hated Jesus. He was healing people, and they were out to get him for not working within their own little boxes of what was holy or not. It's really a subtle form of idolatry on the part of the Pharisees, ultimately, I think. They, in their arrogance, sort of have believed their own propaganda and thought they could decide what kind of a man comes to God. God's response was, "Have you met my son Jesus?" And, you know, yeah, it's profound, really. Verse 17 and 18. But Jesus answered them, "My Father is working until now, and I am working." This was why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. Okay, so this is a good reminder of all those out there who think that Jesus never really says he is the Messiah. Jesus calls himself equal with God, and then the Jews, clearly understanding what he was saying, they want to kill him. It's weird to see how people can read the clear statements of Jesus and decide things like, well, he didn't really say he was God at any time. John is full of statements to the contrary, and this is one of them. Well, let's see. We've got a bunch more verses to the end of the chapter, but Jesus gets into a speech here, which I think this is probably a good breaking spot. So what we're going to do is we're going to end here today, and I'm going to say adios for a while, and we'll see you here in another couple days. I'll see if I can try and get one out here early, but it seems like lately just I've been inundated with all sorts of far-out stuff. So at any rate, I hope you guys are doing well. I hope you're being blessed. Please continue to persevere in prayer and fasting and rejoicing in the Lord. Until next time, sayonara.
To you, and from my view, I can't see leaving anymore. Oh, Savannah, you were always my best friend. Oh, Savannah, won't be long till I'll be home.